Bien, bonjour. Nous avons une assistance aussi choisie que d'ordinaire, mais qui est légèrement renouvelée, ce qui fait que je dirais quand même deux, trois mots pour présenter notre ami Willem Jongman, qui est professeur à l'université de Groningen aux Pays-Bas, et qui, en ce qui me concerne, a une certaine importance dans mon appréciation de mes propres fouilles, puisque c'est l'un des personnages qui m'a forcé, par ses outrances, souvent d'ailleurs, il faut le dire, à me poser des questions sur le résultat de mes fouilles et à me rendre compte que ce que je croyais voir n'était pas forcément le reflet de la réalité, mais qui était évidemment transformé par mes propres a priori. De la même façon que lui-même avait des a priori pour regarder la réalité de notre point de vue. Ça m'a donc beaucoup amené à réfléchir, à douter, ce qui est évidemment une vertu essentielle dans notre métier. Et c'est la raison pour laquelle je l'ai invité à venir nous présenter ses dernières recherches, qui évidemment se situent à un niveau très différent de celle des archéologues, puisqu'il examine l'histoire, on pourrait dire, d'un point de vue macroéconomique, alors que nous la regardons d'un point de vue microéconomique. Et il nous a fait donc déjà trois conférences, une sur la démographie dans l'Antiquité et les moyens que l'on a d'approcher les chiffres éventuels et surtout les évolutions. Ensuite, il nous a présenté son opinion sur l'évolution du niveau de vie, ce qui est évidemment important parce que c'est ce qui détermine la demande. Il a présenté mercredi dernier sa vision de l'économie urbaine et maintenant il va finir par l'économie rurale qui évidemment est fondamentale puisque c'est la base même de la richesse dans l'Antiquité. Avant de lui laisser la parole, je me dois de remplir une cérémonie qu'il n'a pas voulu faire le premier jour parce qu'il disait qu'il ne l'avait pas mérité. Alors je ne sais pas s'il a mérité. Désormais, en tout cas, c'est le moment ou jamais de lui offrir la médaille du Collège de France qui sera donc un souvenir de ces quatre conférences qu'il vient de nous donner.
Merci beaucoup. C'est un bon souvenir d'une période très heureuse. Merci beaucoup. In my first lecture, I argued that the Roman Empire witnessed substantial population growth in Italy from the late 4th or early 3rd century BC, and somewhat later in the provinces, sometimes, and interestingly, already beginning before the Roman conquest. This population growth continued into the 1st century AD, after which a high ceiling seems to have been reached. Afterwards, particularly from the Antonine Plague that struck the empire in AD 166 and the years thereafter, the trend was reversed, particularly in the West and sometimes catastrophically. The data for this proposition were rural field surveys from various regions in the empire, but, as I argued, even if they show similar patterns, a more comprehensive integration of such survey data is an important desideratum. What are the similarities and the differences in magnitude and chronology between regions? And does it help us to identify driving forces for growth and decline? Last week, I also argued that rural population growth was mirrored by a growth in the number and size of towns, even if a subsequent decline, though obvious in individual cases, cannot yet be shown in a more aggregate way. In my second lecture, I argued that such population growth was not followed by Malthusian checks. On the contrary, with population growth, prosperity increased as well, both, it seems, in the countryside and in the towns. And again, unlike in the Malthusian model, and unlike after the Black Death of the 14th century, the population decline after the Antonine Plague or the Cyprianic plague did not inaugurate a period of increasing labor incomes and popular prosperity. Not at all. So how could this be? If we look at the urban economy, population pressure does not necessarily have to be a problem. Urban production primarily uses two factors of production, labor and capital. If labor supply increases, factor proportions can be maintained by the simple use of more capital. Here, the only condition that has to be fulfilled is that there is sufficient purchasing power in society to maintain demand for urban goods and services. Remember, by and large, these are not subsistence goods. If much of society lives at or near subsistence, this is not a workable scenario. And if increasing urban wages have to be supported as well, the challenge is even bigger. One thing that could be done is to replace labor with capital, whenever possible. But this only works so far with given technologies. So in this scenario, it helps enormously if total factor productivity can be increased as well, meaning that the same quantities of labor and capital begin to produce more. In other words, if there is technical change. This can be with human capital, i.e. education and training, with better management, or with better machines, buildings, etc. So rising urban wages coinciding with a growing urban population are only possible with a mix of capital intensification and new technologies, which I will both leave to Jean-Pierre Brun to deal with, and with increased demand for those goods and services. Such rural economic growth is only possible if there is enough prosperity to support this demand for urban goods and services. Some of that increasing demand will have had an urban origin, but as we also noted last week, the urban elite and sub-elite derived significant income from their rural properties. And indeed, in a pre-industrial economy, where agriculture represents such a large part of production and consumption, prosperity and income growth have to come from the rural sector as well, and perhaps even primarily. However, unlike in the urban economy, where expansion could be achieved by adding matching quantities of capital to a growing labor force, the same is not nearly so easy in agriculture, because land is in fairly inelastic supply. Terracing could make hillsides useful, and draining marshes and wetlands was another option. However, all such things were expensive and did not necessarily add that much. The biggest contribution was probably made by deforestation. In central parts of the empire, this was mostly for the wood, for building, but perhaps even more for fuel. The Roman lifestyle required much fuel for bath, but so did the heavy use of metal, ceramics, glass, or the use of concrete as a building material. In Mediterranean parts of the empire, large tracts of land lost their forest cover, even if the land at higher elevations did not necessarily add that much agriculturally useful land. Elsewhere, deforestation was often primarily driven by the need for more agricultural land. The archaeobotanical record shows that forests were replaced by cropland in many provincial lands until, in late antiquity, the process began to move in reverse. Even in now desert areas such as Libya, the UNESCO Libyan Valleys Project has shown how Roman agricultural settlement moved further and further south in what is now barren desert. Yet, expanding cropland is not always an easy option, and particularly not in the already densely populated core areas of the empire. Getting more calories and more value from the same land was often the only option. Here, of course, farmers were running up against the age-old problem of declining marginal labour productivity, given the more or less fixed quantity of land. Doubling labour input on the same land would not double output. What could they do to maintain returns to scale rather than suffer declining returns? Or could they perhaps even increase their returns to scale? For this, specialization is usually the key. A good example of how to think about this could be the work by Jan de Vries, the American economic historian, on the Dutch rural economy in the Golden Age. This was a period of rapid population growth, and to try to understand it, de Vries identified two potential responses. The first he called the peasant model. Here, peasants respond to the threat of reduced labour income by reducing their outside purchases. They try to be as autarkic as possible, growing all their own food and producing as many tools, etc., by themselves. The result is inevitable. Hard work during longer and longer hours, the use of more and more family labour, and a low-quality material culture. Self-exploitation of the worst kind. The alternative would be what de Vries called the specialization model, where farmers concentrate on what they are best at and produce more and more of that for the market while buying everything else in the market. Buying part of their food, but also agricultural implements and other things in the market. In this way, a mutually beneficial trade emerges between farmers, often in different regions, and between town and country. Of the two, this is the model that brings greatest prosperity to all in both town and country. So what happened in the Roman case? The traditional model for ancient agriculture is that of the dominance of cereal agriculture. Of course, this is connected to two pessimistic parts of the orthodoxy. The first is that of the low standard of living of the mass of the population. The second is that of the centrality of the subsistence peasant farmer. Cereals provided the cheapest calories, and a subsistence peasant who did not want to depend on the outside market had to produce his own cereals, supplemented perhaps by the fruits of an olive tree, a vegetable patch, maybe a few chicken hopping around the farm, and that would be it. It's an image the Romans themselves rather liked, of the stout traditional peasant working on his family farm and only leaving it to fight in Rome's army or, like Cincinnatus, to save the state. Of course, it's a myth. This image cannot possibly explain the growing prosperity in the later Republican period or the increasing urbanization. There's also a different narrative, and it's equally implausible, and it's equally moralizing. This is the narrative that we also discussed earlier of the rise of villa agriculture and the growth of rural slavery. Again, it's a narrative based in Italy, but here the great story of the plain and dutiful Roman peasant is spoiled by the duties of warfare abroad, eviction from his land and migration to the cities, and to Rome in particular, and the growth of slave-based villa agriculture. Now, of course, villa agriculture did increase, and of course, wine production did increase as well. But we must be careful to distinguish the possible from the impossible, and be skeptical about the moralizing tone of our written sources. A simple calculation shows that at what some consider a low yield of perhaps 2,000 liters per hectare of wine, and with an annual consumption of 100 liters per head for men, women, and children, only 5% of Italian agricultural land would be needed to satisfy 10 million happy drinkers. So as I said before, you do not need that much land to produce a lot of wine. And even if you put some more different numbers into the equation, the conclusion cannot be radically different. So this extreme version of the story doesn't fly either. Similar calculations are also possible for olive oil, and the outcome is comparable. You can produce quite a bit of oil on relatively little land, even if for oil the margin of uncertainty is rather greater. So what other possibilities were there? In the second lecture, we have seen that salted fish became a meaningful component of the diet. Unlike fresh fish, salted fish can be kept and transported, allowing inland regions to consume these proteins. Archaeologically, the rise and subsequent decline in the production and trade of salted fish products are clearly visible, as we saw, and as Annalisa Marzano had also shown so clearly. It allowed owners of coastal properties a handsome income and permitted the labour-intensive production of high-value food without using much land. It was an excellent solution in a world where land was becoming relatively scarce, but it did presuppose enough purchasing power from consumers. These were, after all, not cheap calories. The rapidly rising consumption of meat that we saw similarly presupposed serious purchasing power, but in this case, it could also require land. Not probably very much in the case of the meat that Romans like most, pork, because pigs can feed on waste and can even be kept in towns. Sheep and goats, however, did require pasture, but much of that seems to have been higher up in the mountains on land that was less favourable for agriculture, so it doesn't really compete that much. Sheep and goats were kept for their meat, for wool, and for the milk. That, short of refrigeration, could be made into cheese. Chicken also seemed to have been on the rise, as we noted in my second lecture. And of course, they had the advantage that they could be kept around the house and could be eaten in one family meal. You didn't need others to share them with, nor did you need to process them into, for example, sausages that you could keep for long. Well-excavated sites are full of chicken bone. In my second lecture, I mentioned the increased importance of fruit and vegetables in the diet. Obviously, these made for a healthier and tastier diet. But they were also a labour-intensive way to produce a lot of high-value calories on a small plot, preferably in close proximity to towns. They assumed an urban market with enough purchasing power. With that, they were a great way to use a lot of labour profitably. A similar argument applies to wine. If we estimate a wine yield of 2,000 litres per hectare, this could quench the thirst of some 20 people, assuming, as I did before, that their consumption would be some 100 litres per annum for both male and female adults and for children. Compare this to the yield of a hectare of cereals, perhaps 500 kilograms net of seed on cropped land, so 250 kilograms per hectare in a two-field system. 250 kilogram would be the subsistence requirement of one average person. Another way of looking at it would be to calculate the calorie yield of a hectare of vineyard. 2,000 litres of the sweet white wine that Romans drank by preference amounts to 3.3 million kilocalories, or almost five times the net calorie yield of a hectare of wheat. I appreciate that such estimates are fraught with difficulties and are disputed, but I honestly believe that no disagreement can undermine the implications of the argument. That is, is viticulture, far more calories per hectare could be produced than with cereals. If only the Romans drank enough, there would be no hunger. A similar argument can also be made for olive oil, though there, both production and consumption estimates are rather less secure. Now, in a market economy, however, food is not produced because people are hungry, but because a profit can be made. And that seems to have been the case. Not only did these crops produce more calories per hectare, but these were also expensive calories. At the perhaps most typical wheat price for at least Italy of about 3 sesterces per modius, 250 kilograms of wheat cost 115 sesterces. So that's your annual gross return. Conversely, with wine and oil, we're in a completely different ballpark. The average of all known prices of an amphora of wine is 36 sesterces, which equates to a gross revenue of almost 2,800 sesterces per hectare. So, if calorie yield was already some 5 times higher than with wheat, gross revenue would be more than 20 times. Doing the same kind of sum for olive oil is more tricky, but still suggests a revenue of some 1,000 to 1,500 sesterces per hectare and a price per calorie that is perhaps double that of cereals. So, producing oil and wine gives far more calories per hectare and effectively removes the carrying capacity ceiling implied by reconstructions that simplify the story to one of cereal production and consumption. I've been guilty too. Far more people could thus be fed. Similarly, also far more people could be employed working on the land. Estimates for labour demand for the crops vary significantly, but seem to converge on a figure of 5 to 10 times more labour demand for wine and oil than for cereals. So making even a partial shift to these crops could not only feed far more people, but also keep far more people employed. And it is precisely that combination that was needed in the face of population pressure. At the same time, these were, of course, far more expensive crops, and particularly it would seem wine. Therefore, they not only represent a big growth in the value of agricultural production, but they also presuppose a preceding and adequate rise in purchasing power. Destitute peasants and destitute urban craftsmen could not afford to drink wine, but they did. And the same argument, of course, applies to crops like fruits and vegetables. What I want to do next is to look into 2 archaeological case studies. The first is from a recent book by Daphne Lentius, a young Dutch archaeobotanist. It's called Landscape and Land Use in First Millennium BC Southeast Italy, recently published last month in Amsterdam, on changes in food production and consumption in the south of Italy during the first millennium BC. The book is far richer than I can do justice to, but it's a very good example of how such archaeobotanical work throws light on big historical questions. The core of her work is a study of 2 sites in southeastern Italy, one covering only the classical period and the other much of the millennium. Although both sites show differences for the earlier periods, and although some other and primarily coastal sites already show some expansion in the classical period, the big change occurred again in the later 4th and early 3rd century. Again, it's that period. Agricultural activity increased with the growth of significant numbers of dispersed farms in the countryside, and with the emergence or growth of crops such as fruits and vegetables, olive oil, and particularly wine. Most of these had existed before in that area, at least from the archaic age, but now they emerged in abundance. Her conclusion is clear. These crops were produced for the market. Interestingly, the process had clearly started well before the region's conquest by Rome, even if the latter gave the growth of this market agriculture an additional boost. Now, this is important because one all too easily assumes that these changes were simply the product of Roman expansion. They were not. There is good evidence that in many parts of southern Italy, such changes antedated Rome and were part of the growth of a more integrated Mediterranean economy. In fact, the growth of Rome itself may be part of that larger process rather than the engine of it. Remember, Rome's capture of Capua happened only just before Alexander the Great conquered the East. Unfortunately, Daphne Lensch's book doesn't really continue into the Roman period. I would have loved to see the rest of the story, but alas, we cannot have it all. But what we have is clear, and a welcome addition to the excellent field survey work in this area that has been done by a number of teams. Now, the book also makes an important methodological point. However much we survey settlement patterns and surface finds, without archaeobotanical work, we will not know the vegetation history, and we cannot properly reconstruct what people did primarily, i.e. growing crops. To conclude this section on southeast Italy, I want to add that there is also good evidence for increased animal husbandry and for the increased importance of pigs in particular, and hence meat. There's also some evidence for selective breeding for larger sizes of animals. This work on southeast Italy also underscores the importance of excavation of farms to see how they developed over time and to provide archaeobotanical and archaeozoological assemblages. Surveys collect charts, but not seeds or bones. Thus far, the number of such excavations of farms and other modest sites is small, exceedingly small, in fact. Part of this is research traditions, with excavators keen to excavate impressive sites, and survey archaeologists locked into their own traditions. But that is not all. There is also a big and administrative hurdle, in the sense that permission to excavate is much harder to obtain than to do a survey. It's therefore all the more important that there is now a targeted Roman peasant project that attempts to excavate a limited number of such structures in an area in Tuscany that is also surveyed. See the papers of the British School in Rome 2011 for some first results. And combining these two research strategies at the extremes of the scale of research intensity, i.e. excavation on the one hand and survey on the other hand, they combine it with modern geophysical work sort of in the middle to see what can be done with the most intensive non-destructive work, sort of ground radar, magnetic resistance and so on. That's modern technology. Their first excavation immediately shows the potential of such work and also the problems. Their Pievina site had an interrupted existence because it was covered by a landslide in the later 1st century AD and was only reoccupied in a much more modest scale in late antiquity. So they have no uninterrupted sequence, and chronological comparison is not necessarily valid. they lacked the interesting bit in the middle. They also had to limit themselves to the excavation of only a small part of the earlier phase. Turned out it was much bigger than they thought, so they didn't. They could only do a little chunk of it. And as a result, they couldn't adequately reconstruct what the whole site was. And it was going to be destroyed the next year. So they learned a number of lessons, as they expected. This was their pilot project. What is clear from their work is that easy functional generalizations about the meaning of a particular site category are dangerous. This peasant farm, if that is in fact what it is, was clearly connected to the outside world in terms of pottery or the presence, for example, of garum, but also because the granary was far too large for simple home consumption. Production must have been quite substantial, also given the prominence of bone from older cattle, presumably used as work animals, and therefore incidentally, for those who enjoy that sort of things, contradicting my own hypothesis of many years ago work animals were rare. At least in this case, it's contradicted. Cooking vessels suggest that meat from older cattle did indeed figure quite prominently in the diet. But for the Republican and early imperial period, the same applied to pork. There we have it again, pork. So all in all, this recent excavation shows the problems you run into, but also the potential of such work. And it shows the importance of two modern methods. The first is geophysics. Geophysics had shown up all structures that were later found. So it's really useful. The second is the importance of archaeological science. If we want to study ancient agriculture, we need both archaeobotany and archaeozoology, or whatever will come in the future. My next case study comes from near Rome and from the Pontine region survey by my Groningen archaeology colleagues Peter Attema, Timon de Haas, Gijs Tol, and their many collaborators, mostly students, of course. This map shows the location of the area and notes the Via Appia. Just going through it. Pictures are from their chapter in the Oxford Studies in Roman Economy volume on settlement, urbanization, and population. The next slide shows the number of sites per time period. I would not have put time on the vertical axis myself, but it doesn't really matter too much. Light blue is certain sites, and the dark red is possible sites. In reality, not all possible or uncertain sites are real, of course, so reality was probably somewhere in between no possible sites, and all possible sites are real. But where precisely, we of course do not know. Note the large number of sites in the 6th century. Okay. Even if that's outside our current scope of interest. The most obvious thing, of course, is the rapid rise in the number of sites from 350 BC onwards. This is the 350 BC. You see, there it goes up. This is precisely the period, 350 BC, when things also started to change in the southeastern Italy. Change was clearly in the air. Also, note the marked decline after 250. This is the 100 to 250. And thereafter, it plunges. A decline, however, that may have started even earlier. As you can see already, AD 100 to 250, which to help you a bit, because it's already less than before. And it's not inconceivable, in fact, that much of the decline was actually in the second half of the period. The dating of the period AD 100 to 50 is based on so-called African red slip pottery that covers precisely this period. If, as I've argued in my first lecture, the turning point was in the years after the Antonine Plague of AD 166 and later, this long time period may well mask a more abrupt decline, because it covers both sides of the turning point that I argue existed. So what we need is more precise chronology within African red slip ware. I've been told the prospects for that are pretty good, but we're not yet there. Anyway, whether the decline already started late in the second century or not, the subsequent decline is certainly marked. But you should also note that for the period 30 BC to AD 250, the evidence seems to be rather more robust. Certain sites represent a rather larger proportion of the total than before and after. See? This is not surprising. As we shall see later, this is also the period of the richest material culture. So these farms were much harder to miss because their inhabitants used more ceramics than either before or after. There were not only more sites and presumably more people, but they were also richer, as we shall see in more detail later on. The next step is to see what sites we are dealing with and if this changes over time. After all, we remember the stories in Appian and Plutarch on the demise of the small peasant. As you can see, in both the graphs, for certain and possible farms, this is the certainly identified, and these are the sort of the with the potential one, the less secure ones as well. So you can see there are more of those on the right than on the left. Okay, let me see. In both the graphs for certain and possible farms, the number is effectively stable until 30 BC. The small farmers didn't disappear at all. See? Here this is stable, and here too. Oh. There's no real change. At the same time, you can see that there was indeed a steady rise in the number of villas on top. The yellow, the light yellow and the blue stuff. Both inland and along the coast, particularly from the first century BC. So something was indeed happening. The often mentioned late antique decline is also visible. And as you can see, it was stronger for farms than for villas. Villas decline, but not so badly. It's the small farmers who finally are almost wiped out in late antiquity. Finally, we want to see what this means for population and for economic and social relations. As you can see here, quite a bit of the population growth is driven by the growth of villas. Farm population is relatively stable for quite a while until the late antique decline, when villas became the dominant type of habitation for many, even there were also far fewer of them. So, in conclusion, we can say that the traditional pessimistic picture is wrong, in the sense that the small farms did not disappear. But at the same time, it's also clear that the surge in population largely originated in the growth of villa agriculture and hence was closely connected to the growth of agricultural production for the market. That connection is easily visible if we map the data for the first century BC and the first century AD. You can see the site distribution. This is not very clear, I'm afraid, but you can see the Roman, the roads, the red ones, and you see lots of rivers and so on. That's the blue lines. The distribution pattern is clearly connected to both the river system and, in particular for the villa sites, also to the road system. Transport matters for your location. There's nothing surprising here. It's a story that is consistent with everything else we know, and it makes sense. If you want to sell to the market, you have to have access to that market. Finally, I want to come back to the slide I showed you in my second lecture on standard of living. As I said on that occasion, this uses the population trend pictured at the top. To deflate the survey data on fine tableware and amphorae. So it's the shape of the top graph is used to divide the number of amphorae shirts and the number of fine tableware shirts, and the result of that division is what is graphed here. These are not the gross numbers of the shirts. These are divided by the shape of the population graph. So they're sort of per capita numbers. And the purpose is to identify per capita availability of fine tableware and amphorae. This is in the same Nettuno area that we've been looking at. So it's an example of what you could do with that sort of data, and it's only from a small area. And I won't claim that this represents the entire Roman Empire, but this is just something you might do, and if we have more data like this, we can do it for lots of other sites as well. And as I said 2 weeks ago, the conclusion is very clear, here at least. Precisely in the period of greater population pressure, when the Malthusian scenario would predict a deterioration of standard of living, these data show exactly the opposite. Population growth went hand in hand with increased prosperity, or at least with increased numbers of amphorae and fine tableware shirts. There are obviously also problems. Andrei Chernia will immediately see that the graph for amphorae shirts goes down very early on. And it doesn't necessarily mean that people stop drinking wine, because thereafter probably they drank it from wooden barrels or sacks or whatever. But so it's not the perfect representation of reality, but even so. This is not about when it goes down, but when it went up. It looks as if the growth of market-oriented, high added value, intensive agriculture did stave off a decline of standard of living, and in fact achieved precisely the opposite. Of course, I do not need to remind you that some good excavations with archaeobotanical data would fill in this story wonderfully. Finally, this poses the question of the decline of the system, here and everywhere in at least the Western Empire. The East is different. I do believe the Antonine Plague first and the Cyprianic Plague later are an important part of that story. We saw the impact on real wages in Egypt, And we can see their disruptive impact in many other walks of life. As Richard Duncan Jones has shown, public building in Italy came to an almost complete standstill. And the consequences in this graph from my student Fritz Heinrich, where we calculated the stock of public buildings in Italy by giving them a life expectancy of 200 years. So they live for 200 years, these buildings, and then they die. So you can only have a constant amount of public buildings if you keep building them. If you stop building, your stock of useful buildings begins to decline. The oldest ones die first. So then you see here, precise, this is the top. And because from then on, no new public buildings, or almost no new public buildings are being built, you see the number decline. It's an estimation, it's not reality, but it shows the kind of process that was taking place. This is existing buildings, and assuming that each year 1/200th of them fall in disrepair, and that you get the new build, and then in the earlier period, not more new buildings were being built than old buildings that were disintegrating in this model, and after a while, because no new buildings are being built, the stock of buildings slowly declines. Gives you some idea. Similarly, Richard Duncan Jones showed the public administration in Egypt received a big shock. Also, gladiatorial games virtually stopped because it seems urban elites could no longer afford this expense either. Or the Tyrian traders in Puteoli had to write to their hometown for financial support for their statio, their trading station, because their numbers had recently dwindled. All of this happening. Werner Eck has shown the dramatic impact on military recruitment, as evident from the military diplomata. Mining in several areas came to a standstill, I presume for lack of miners, for lack of demand for the product of the mines, or a combination of the two. I think it's clear that the Antonine Plague had a dramatic impact. I also think that it's clear that it was not a Malthusian positive check. Things were not obviously going badly in the preceding period. One could, of course, argue that the combination of population growth, unprecedented urbanization, and high levels of connectivity had made the empire vulnerable. Arguably, it was a disaster waiting to happen. But there's also another dimension. Just like we now know that the Black Death of the 14th century was preceded by a succession of bad harvests and a rapid and dramatic deterioration of the climate, thanks to the work of Bruce Campbell, something similar seems to have been the case in the years before and after the Antonine Plague. Interestingly, and quite possibly crucially, the late Republican and early imperial period had enjoyed rather favorable weather, it seems, the so-called Roman warm period. Tree ring data indicate that the years before the Antonine Plague marked the end of that period of favorable climate and witnessed a severe reduction of tree growth. You see, this is sort of the beginning of the end. And this is a really pretty severe dip. Late antiquity is a grim time. Chilly life. Now, climate history is a young field of scientific research with lots of controversy. And specifically, Mediterranean data are scarce. This is from Northern Europe. But it may well be true that here we have an important part of the explanation for the success of the economy in the last centuries BC and the first centuries AD, and for the subsequent decline. Theoretically, Climate change can be seen as negative technological change. The same quantities of land and labor now produce less. Total factor productivity was declining, and everybody would be worse off. The similarity with the Black Death of the 14th century obviously invites a follow-up question. After all, and apart from the apocalyptic horror, the Black Death was a blessing in disguise for the survivors, both in the short term and in the longer term. In the short term, wages and popular standard of living went up in the 14th century because labor was now scarce. Conversely, rents went down, and so did landowner incomes and the power of the feudal elite. In short, the Black Death inaugurated a period of economic innovation to cope with the higher cost of wage labor and political and social realignment. As we know, this is not really what happened in the Roman case. On the contrary, as it so happens, the decades after the Antonine Plague saw a flurry of epigraphically surviving petitions to the emperor by peasant communities who complained that large landowners were conspiring with local officials to sometimes very violently oppress peasants who insisted on traditional rights. The famous inscription by the peasants of the Saltus Burunitanus is the best known, but there are quite a few of these. Of course, the emperors wrote back that this was all wrong and should not happen. It's not part of our style of government. But it's equally clear that nothing really improved. So, after a generation or so, these inscriptions stop, presumably because the peasants had come to realize that they had entered a harsher world. At the crucial junction, the empire was taking a different turn from Europe in the 14th century. Rather than give labor its new and relatively higher value in the market, social relations became more unequal and oppressive, just like they did in early modern Eastern Europe during the so-called Second Serfdom. The distinction between free and unfree, and between citizen and non-citizen, became blurred, to be replaced by the new distinction between honestiores and humiliores, where the mass of the population was in the latter category. Only few were honestior. With the Constitutio Antoniniana of AD 212, citizenship was extended to almost all free inhabitants, precisely when its meaning had been eroded. In the early empire, Romans had been citizens, now they became subjects. Rome changed from what Acemoglu and Robinson call an inclusive society to an extractive society. And that, they argue, is Why Nations Fail, the title of their book. Rome's success had been remarkable, combining rapid population growth, high population density in its core regions, exceptional levels of urbanization, and truly urban life, internal peace and stability, successful legal and economic institutions, impressive pre-industrial technologies, all in one powerful mix that pushed the envelope of what was possible for a pre-industrial society. But it did not escape from the very limitations of such a pre-industrial economy. One horrific sign of that is that at no moment in time did it manage to improve life expectancy or health, as we saw. Almost on the contrary. Health may have been the price, bad health may have been the price people paid for their prosperity. Rome managed to achieve a high level equilibrium well above subsistence, but that equilibrium was and remained a precarious one. Remove some of the foundations and the building collapses. So, in the end, Finlay was wrong to portray ancient Rome as an unsuccessful ancestor to the medieval and early modern world. At the same time, he was of course right that it never had the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. But putting it in those terms, as was effectively done at the beginning of the debate around the turn of the 19th and the 20th century, had been the wrong way to put the question. It blinded everyone for the possibility that history doesn't always move in one direction, and that that direction should always be upwards. Thank you very much.